Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining our webinar today, Choosing Your Path, Direct Real Estate Investments versus REITs, featuring Upside Avenue. Before we get started, we do have a quick disclaimer. NTrust does not provide any investment advice, tax advice, or legal advice. We are not CPAs, attorneys, or financial advisors. We do not recommend or endorse any investments, products, or services. The information in this presentation is for educational purposes only. We do, however, recommend that you seek investment, tax, and legal advice before entering into any investment. Today's agenda for the webinar will cover self-directed IRA basics, why investors consider real estate, the basics of real estate investment trusts, comparing REITs and direct deals, real estate market trends, how to fund a real estate investment, how to use your self-directed IRA to make a real estate investment, and at the end, we will have a Q&A session. We will also be providing both video and audio recordings of the webinar to everyone at the conclusion. My name is Tony Uncle, and I will be your host today. I am the East Coast Business Development Manager for the NTrust Group. I have been in the retirement industry administration space for 3 years, and I have pride in educating investors and professionals on tax-preferred retirement accounts. First, I want to share a little background on our company for those of you who are not already familiar with the NTrust Group. We are a self-directed IRA record keeper custodian who specializes in holding alternative assets inside retirement accounts for our clients. We have been doing this for nearly 40 years, have around 22,000 accounts, and hold roughly $4 billion in investor assets. One factor that makes NTrust unique is our single point of contact business model that we offer our partners and our clients when they open an account with us. We understand this area of business is much more complex, so we provide a higher level of customer service to our clients and our partners. NTrust is self-directed IRA administrators. We have a knowledgeable staff, most with CISP designations. We do have nationwide offices. We are located in New Jersey, Nashville, Tennessee, and California. We hold in-person events and virtual webinars. We provide a national continuing education program for other credentials. And we sponsor an IRA academy where we actually teach the course and train other people in our industry to pass the CISP course. What is a self-directed IRA? A retirement account in which the individual investor is in charge of making all investment decisions. A self-directed IRA provides the investor with greater opportunity for asset diversification outside of traditional stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. For example, real estate, private tax liens, and notes can be purchased. All securities and investments are held in an account administered by a custodian or a trustee. Benefits of a self-directed IRA, you're in full control, complete diversification of your portfolio, and tax benefits. At this time, we'd like to hand it over to Upside Avenue, and she will take you through real estate investing, REITs, or direct purchasing. And as we said at the end, we'll come back to a few topics with NTrust and then have time for our Q&A.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Tony. Pleasure to be with everybody today. Wonderful. So I'll, can you all hear me clearly?
You sound great to me.
Okay, wonderful. All right. Thanks, everybody. Great to be with you all here. So today's topic is about REITs versus direct deals. And, we'll cover a couple topics today, but just a full disclosure, the presentation that we're giving today is for general information purposes only, doesn't constitute legal or professional advice. Please don't act on the basis of any material in the webinar without obtaining proper legal or other professional advice specific to your situation. So with that, we'll jump right into it. real estate investing, REITs versus direct deals or versus direct purchase. So just to take this up to, you know, maybe 10,000 feet, covering just the major asset classes, there are four major asset classes here that we generally consider for investment. One is holding, holding your money in cash, investing in bonds, investing in property or equities. I think the two most popular seem to be, you know, equities, which is like stocks and bonds, followed by alternative asset classes like property and commodities, and, you know, even today Bitcoin, actually, which is really a form of cash in some instances. So with that, we're going to be focusing more on property, which is the real estate component. So the question is, you know, why do we invest in real estate? A couple key strengths for real estate, really. One is cash flow. Real estate is a high cash flow vehicle. It generates steady returns typically, people like it for that. Another one is appreciation. Real estate tends to appreciate over time as rents increase, operating income increases. Real estate tends to track and grow with that, generally with the broader economy or even better than in some cases. A third is that real estate offers diversification. What this means is of the four major asset classes, they all operate differently. The fundamentals are all a little different for all of them with regard to whether they generate cash flow or appreciation in the case of cash is a store of value, or in the case of commodities, sometimes is a store of value. So real estate offers a diversification in that respect, in that you're spreading your investment across asset classes like real estate that offer you protections, you know, risks, rewards are different for each of these categories. So you spread that across. Another one is tax benefits. So real estate is particularly strong from a tax benefit standpoint. This goes back to, thousands of years ago, feudal times where land was the most valuable commodity or most valuable asset for lords of the day. Since then, you know, the tax laws and the financial structure has always benefited real estate, particularly so from a tax perspective. Another one is that real estate is a great inflation hedge. As prices go up, real estate is a real asset versus a nominal asset. So what that means is it's a physical thing with real people that need to make real use of it. So that has a tendency to withstand inflation and become more valuable as inflation increases. Real estate is also very generally lower correlated. What this means is that versus the other asset classes, as an investor, you're always looking for diversification because it lowers correlation of your returns, meaning it de-risks your returns from the perspective of when stocks are down or bonds are down or, you know, commodities are down. Real estate may be high, or it could also be the other way around, where, you know, real estate may be underperforming while the other asset classes are outperforming at certain periods of time. But on the whole, having a diversified portfolio of different asset classes with low correlations to each other, as is real estate to the rest of the investment universe, creates a more robust portfolio for you, the investor. Strong adjusted returns from real estate comes from the fact that real estate can be leveraged. And, you know, your bank is always willing to give you leverage on real estate versus, you know, to some degree on some other asset classes, a bank will not give you leverage. So that ability to lever up real estate at very, very low cost of capital from a debt perspective allows you to see a strong risk adjusted return on the equity level, which is our equity investment in deals. And finally, I think I spoke to this a little bit. Real estate is a tangible asset. There are many different kinds of assets out there, you know, taking again, you know, digital currency as another asset class. That is an intangible asset. Real estate, however, is the most tangible asset, class out there. It is, you can touch it, feel it, smell it, and it doesn't move. So that's the idea. Now, there's within the real estate universe, we generally, from an institutional perspective, break it out into four major asset classes, which is office. The office buildings where we work, industrial, what serves sort of the cities and gets our goods moving and transporting. Think of Amazon warehouses. Retail, which is where we like to, you know, play, dine, experience life, and where we live, housing, which comes in all sorts of different forms, from single family, duplexes, multifamily housing, hotels, all of that. So these are the four major and sort of institutional food groups, we call them, or major real estate types. Just looking at a brief history over the last, 10 years or so. What this chart is showing, you'll see four major groups of charts. On the left, you'll see 1 year, then followed by 3 years, 5 years, and 10-year holds. What this chart is showing you is what average returns have been by investment class. And the different colors represent different things. Apartments is orange. You'll see industrial in yellow. You'll see hotel in gray, which on the one-year column, you can see it's in quite a negative. Obviously, COVID has had an impact in the last year, year and a half or so on that industry. But in general, what this chart shows you is the relative returns by sector that we see in real estate. So they're all different. And just like different asset classes, i.e. stocks, bonds, real estate, cash could be different. Every subsector, sub-asset class in real estate also has a very different profile. For example, multifamily tends to be very diversified. So if you buy a 200-unit apartment building or apartment community, you have 200 individual streams of income paying you rent, and they cycle every month. You'll see maybe 1/12 of those renters renew their leases. They may go somewhere else. Somebody new may come in. Versus in a product like industrial, you may have, call it, let's just use Amazon as an example. They may sign up a million square feet in a single building and be there for 10 years. But at the end of 10 years, they may decide that their requirements have changed and they may vacate that entire building, right? So then you've got a complete loss of cash flow and the need to recycle more capital into the property to get it released to the next Amazon or the next resident or a tenant, rather. So every asset class is a little different, and that's what this chart is showing. This next chart just shows, during COVID, really you can see apartments and industrial have done very, very well. Office has done somewhat well, and depending on sort of where it's been, but hotels and retail, obviously, as we've all seen, have taken quite a hit from the lockdowns and from the loss of travel. So that speaks a little bit, hopefully, to asset classes. Next is risk and return. This is really, as an investor, what we really focus on. And then this will start to now dive into REITs versus direct investing. But from a risk return perspective, we generally look at it across a spectrum from core plus to value add to opportunistic assets. What this means is basically what type of physical real estate are we investing in and what type of business plan do we have for the real estate to improve its value or enjoy its returns. In the case of core, they tend to be the best located properties in any given city. They tend to generate strong, steady returns. They're fully occupied. It's the most desirable properties that you can look for. On the far end of the spectrum are opportunistic assets. This could be ground up development. This could be an extraordinarily distressed asset that has had a lot of trouble and is no longer even able to pay the debt. So you might go in and buy the asset at a steep discount, but take on all of the work that's required to improve it, get it leased back up, make it stabilized, and bring the risk back down the value spectrum. And by doing so, you increase and you create value. So those are two far-ended business sort of business plans for different types of assets. But it's important to understand this because you as an investor need to know yourself, one, and need expert guidance as well as to where you should be investing depending on how much capital you have to invest and depending on sort of your long-term plans and various other factors that you should discuss with your financial advisor, CPAs, and such. So just from that perspective on risk and return, this is where it sort of now starts to dial into REITs versus direct deals. REITs tend to be larger, more diversified buckets of investing. It's a vehicle created specifically to invest in a diversified manner versus a direct deal is a way to concentrate. So as you'll see from here, we'll go down a quick list of, cash flow returns. A direct deal gets its returns from distributable cash flow and appreciation versus a REIT being a diversified vehicle gets its returns via dividends and appreciation. From a day-to-day management standpoint, a direct deal, if you're an investor in a direct deal, you might be the ultimate investor, which is, you're buying your own property and you're DIYing it. You buy your own 8-unit building or 12-unit or larger, whatever size you choose, and do it yourself. That's one way of doing it. Or you can hire your own management company, but the management company is there to execute on a day-to-day basis and you are there to make major decisions. So when a hailstorm hits and a roof is damaged, the property manager is calling you and saying, what do I do? That's sort of one way of approaching it with a direct deal. On a REIT basis, the By nature, the REIT hires a competent management team to handle all of these items for you as an investor. So the REIT managers will manage the fund and will allow you to stay hands off from an investment. So it's, again, it's that diversification versus concentration sort of approach. From an exiting standpoint, direct deals tend to be illiquid. It's just the nature of the securities laws and the way things are set up. They tend to favor long-term investments, large check sizes, versus REIT vehicles were created for the public. So they're liquid, they can be traded or non-traded, and they're just generally, they're not always completely liquid as a publicly traded stock would be, but they are more liquid, generally speaking, than direct deals. And it depends on the holding period and other terms of the REIT offering. From a risk profile, direct deals can be of any sort, REITs can be of any sort, but generally what we do see in practice is that direct deals are focused more on opportunistic, value-add opportunistic investments. They entail higher risks, and the goal is to generate an outsized profit, versus with a REIT, it's generated to create steady returns and appreciation over time. Again, we're leveraging that ability to diversify and spread out the risk across a portfolio. So it's more hands-off and more steady Eddie. From an investor qualification standpoint, I think I mentioned this briefly, direct deals typically are restricted to higher check sizes, which also from SEC regulations requires many direct deals, if not most direct deals, depending on the securities laws, to be open only to what we call accredited investors. And in fact, there's even higher from the 1940 securities laws. There are even qualified clients, which stand to an even higher threshold. However, REITs, on the other hand, are widely generally open to the public if structured correctly. So with that, you know, it tells you a little bit about where you're hoping you're starting to get a sense of where you might want to be investing, either direct deals or a REIT, depending on your personal situation. Now, we'll dive a little bit into REITs later. We'll cover direct deals. But just real quick, a REIT is basically, as I mentioned, a vehicle of funded pooled capital to invest institutionally into deals. You earn profits basically without owning a property. What you actually own is you're a shareholder in the REIT. So you own shares and you get dividend income from it and from appreciation. Entry barriers into a REIT are generally very, very low. For ours, Upside Avenue REIT, it's a $2,000 minimum check, although many of our investors tend to be much larger, including six-figure checks. But at the very least, if you've got a smaller amount, you can invest that way with a minimum of $2,000. Dividends tend to be generally higher for REITs. I think this goes to somewhat of the risk reward structure generally of a REIT. It's created as a diversified vehicle to generate cash flow. So that with our REIT generally right now, historically, it's been about 5% dividends, plus then there's appreciation component, which is then gets us to our targeted returns. And then the potential for appreciation tends to be more steady because, again, this is a diversified set of properties that we invest in, and it is a portfolio as opposed to a single property. Relatively more liquid, as mentioned. Now, one of the cons of a REIT is that it follows the same dividend interest income parameters from the IRS, which doesn't generally benefit the investor from a depreciation standpoint. Now, how this affects you specifically, obviously defer to your CPA and your tax professionals, but some of the tax advantages that are offered on direct deals, i.e. depreciation pass-through, is not offered on a REIT. There are advantages to REITs, obviously, but again, I will defer to your CPA for that. And then again, for the REIT, you've got a diversity of properties. Here's an interesting nuance that REITs tend to specialize in one of those four areas, office, retail, multifamily, and industrial. The reason being is investors are looking for specialized management teams to focus on something and get really good at it. So you as the investor, when you're looking to diversify, generally you will select a REIT, like ours, we specialize in multifamily specifically. But if you're looking for broad diversification, broad exposure within the real estate class, you might elect to invest in more than one REIT, which specializes in a different segment as well. So REITs offer diversification of properties, not necessarily of an asset class. Going to our REIT for a little bit, we are a multifamily real estate investment trust, and we are really one of the core reasons why we invest specifically in multifamily is because of the tailwinds benefiting the industry right now and for the foreseeable future. So there's a tremendous need for housing. I think we're all seeing it with the skyrocketing house prices. People do need housing. There is a massive influx, specifically in these Sunbelt states in the United States, for housing as people move and relocate from northern states to southern states. We're seeing that demand all across the board. So there's a need of about 350,000 more housing units by 2030. The renter population is growing. This chart basically just shows over time, by 2040, there's a massive expected increase in the need for housing, which benefits multifamily. We also see that the renter household projection, even by age group, is rapidly growing in that sort of 35 to 59 and 60 and over, which is why you'll see a lot of multifamily strategies today tend to focus on Class A luxury and also the senior housing, and which is the 55 and up, 62 and up housing communities, because that demand is growing rapidly and will continue to grow for the foreseeable future. Looking at, interestingly, where people are moving, and this is not only limited to multifamily and to obviously REIT investing, but just in general where people are moving, there are three major moving companies that track where people have taken their business effectively. So where have people rented trucks, or where have people moved from, et cetera. So you've got U-Haul, North American Moving, United Van Lines. You can see Tennessee, Texas, Florida, Ohio, Arizona, and you'll see some repetitive, regions over here. Tennessee shows up, Carolina show up, Arizona shows up. Texas has been a very strong, we have a heavy tech presence in Texas, and that has been a very strong performer today. And even we, as we look into the future, is the expectation there. So with that, people tend to invest from an investment strategy perspective. We see a lot of folks investing in residential real estate, house flipping. We see a lot of groups forming syndicates to buy land or even develop properties. And then your traditional syndication, which is the direct deal investing, and then through REITs. Those are generally the buckets that we're seeing today to tap that opportunity. Now, it's just focusing a little bit more on syndications rather than REITs. Syndications are attractive because of the high cash flow generation potential. When you generally do syndications, they tend to be what we call forced appreciation vehicles, in the sense that you go in with a business plan, on a more risky business plan, but with the outcome being expected to create a far higher net operating income and a far higher valuation, generally on a single asset. So that is very attractive to some people. Also the tax benefits, as we mentioned, there's some flow through tax benefits that you can get on a direct deal that you may not get on a REIT investment or other investments, even outside of real estate. The strong potential for appreciation goes to two components. As I mentioned, one is strong forced appreciation, which is the ability to go in and make changes at the property level, increase NOI and generate appreciation. And then the second one is the standard organic appreciation that occurs with as the average rents in the area grow and as the property rents grow and operating income grows. One other benefit for syndications is generally because there's fewer people invested and it's a single asset, you generally have more ability to ask specific questions and get more hands-on reporting on any specific investment. It goes to this tends to cater more to folks that do like that active, DIY approach. I want to know exactly what's going on with my investments. I want to review the rent roll. I want to review the operating statements every month and understand exactly what's going on. Versus with a REIT, they tend to be more hands-off and say, just go, we trust you. You're competent management. Do what you do. Generate my returns, and everybody's happy. On sort of some of the considerations with a syndication, because it's a single investment, these tend to be smaller syndicators and smaller investment opportunities rather than broad diversified institutional deals. So sponsors' fees tend to be a higher fraction of the deal. Sponsors generally charge acquisitions fees, equity raise fees, asset management fees, and all sorts of different things. And on smaller deals, non-institutional deals, they can be heavier. Sponsors also generate what they call sweat equity or carried interest, which means you provide the capital, they provide the deal and the expertise, and they get an outsized return relative to the dollars they've put into the deal, obviously because they're doing all the work and generating the value for you. This tends to be a lot more muted with REITs, and REITs don't generally, management teams don't generally charge carried interest on the REIT side. Also, because you're investing in a single deal, and according to securities laws, I mentioned it is illiquid, and you generally tend to take on more risk with a direct deal for various reasons. It's not always the case, but just generally in practice, what we see is riskier deals with larger upside potentials per deal tend to favor syndication models. So as you think about where you'd like to invest, how you'd like to invest, what your appetite is, here are some questions to ask yourself. One, what are your long-term investment goals? Where are you trying to get to in life? My financial advisor even personally asks me this every once in a while. Our discussions internally is that, you know, me as the investor, my goal is always to maximize my wealth, and my financial advisor's personal paradigm is that he's always trying to make sure I never go poor, I never turn poor. So you have to see both sides of the coin, you know, risk and reward, and what are your investment goals. Ask yourself, how do you feel about risk? This will have a very direct impact on whether you choose to invest in REITs or whether you choose to invest in direct deals. How liquid does your investment have to be? So you need to think about, do some financial planning for your family and what yourself and your family, and where you see your cash needs over the next 3, 5, 7, 10 year horizons and beyond. And that will help you a long way in making those decisions. How active do you want to be in day-to-day management for your investment is another very valid question to ask oneself. What industry or asset class do you want to invest in? Everyone is different. Some generate more cash, some generate more appreciative return, some have generally consistent cash flow, others tend to be lumpy. It's a real question from that perspective. And then where is the investment? Where is the economic growth projected? Again, those are macro trends that you want to make a decision on. Some people like to invest close to home or would like a diversified portfolio in their own state. Others would say, no, I actually just want to go where the population growth is. It really depends on where, what suits you as an investor. And then, you know, what is the investment model of the REIT or the sponsor? Every investment sponsor or manager has a specific set of core competency, and you want to understand what is their core competency and are they operating within their core competency. That gives you not only an idea of exactly where they're going to generate the risk, the returns, and where the risks lie, but also tells you a little bit about sort of what you would like to accomplish, you know, from an investment model. Last question is, you know, what are the historical and projected returns? This is a track record question, generally very good to ask, understanding where people make their returns and how they plan to continue to make their returns in the future, both from a REIT manager or from a sponsor standpoint. So, you know, with that, we do have a quick start guide for investing in real estate. You can email us for your quick guide. We'll defer sort of the contact information to the very end of the presentation. From now, I would like to turn this back over to Tony.
Thank you, Chief. Very informative. So investing in real estate with a self-directed IRA, you have to do your market research, mean property values, average incomes, employment rates, vacancy rates, owner versus renter percentage, disaster analysis, industries present in the area, many things that you need to research before going into an investment. You have to choose your investment. Are you going to do a direct investment or invest in a REIT? And then you complete your transaction. For the direct investment, open an IRA, do your typical real estate transaction from appraisal to financing to inspections, and then to finally your closing. And for the REIT, find your REIT and you invest in the fund. Something very important with real estate investments is income and expenses. Property management maintenance must be paid out of the IRA. All income must be payable to your IRA and not to you personally. So pretty much every dollar that comes and goes from that property must originate in the retirement account. What's next on the interest agenda? Well, our next webinar is Top 10 Disruptive Real Estate Trends. You can register and join us on September 15th. If you would like more information regarding today's topic, you can complete our brief survey at the end of the webinar. Need more information on IRAs in general, please visit our website, theinterestgroup.com, and visit our Learning Center. And as always, you could follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. some new features with Entrust. We have new Entrust iOS app is available in the App Store. If you're curious which projects other Entrust clients are investing in, please visit the Entrust Connect for recent postings and wonder how to choose a proper SDIR self-directed IRA provider. Check out our brand new self-directed IRA kit. Okay, time is for questions. You can type your questions into the question box. We can answer as many as possible. The ones for Entrust, I'll happily answer, and the ones for Upside Avenue, we'll pass over to Chi. And we'll keep both of our contact information up should you have any direct questions. The first question is going to be for Chi. Why do Core Plus and Value Add categories have the exact same three asset types? What makes them different from each other?
It was a Core and Core Plus.
Why do Core Plus and Value Add categories have the exact same three asset types? What makes them different from each other?
Got it. I apologize. So Core Plus and Value Add is a spectrum. And it's actually, I don't think it should be the same three asset types. It's really across all asset types, there are opportunities in the Core Plus Value Add and opportunistic spectrum. Well, what I mean by that is if you take multifamily as an example, the downtown main and main of the city you live in will have core assets. As they start to, the newest, shiniest development in your city is generally what we call trophy or A plus or core assets. They tend to be purchased by REITs. They tend to be purchased by pension funds, big investors, global investors, et cetera. And those trades tend to hit the newspapers. After that, what you'll have is as the asset starts to get a little older, the same property, as it starts to get a little older, it will fall out of favor to that top clientele. And that's usually within about 10 years or so when they start to exit out of those investments and are looking for their next trophy investment. At that point, that same asset will become a Core Plus investment. Generally, there's a little bit of value add if it could be from leasing, from operations, or just a light improvement. For what I mean by that is, core multifamily 10 years ago, may have still included honey cabinets or, could have still included black appliances for some reason or the other. Today, all of that would be converted, or the countertops could have been dark, dark granite. And today, it's all the rage to have light granite, stainless steel, really light and bright cabinet fronts and those kinds of interior finishes. So even tastes may change, which would convert a core asset into a Core Plus asset. Then as the asset starts to get older over time, becomes 15, 20 years old, things start to age. Appliances have a useful life of, anywhere from 5 to 15 years. So once those things start failing and the repairs and maintenance starts to increase, even that class of buyers, those institutional buyers will say, okay, I think we're done with this. We can go find the next asset that's 10 years old, from a Core Plus, and we can improve it a little bit and get a slightly higher yield and move on. At that point, those assets then start to move into value add territory. And those value add buyers are saying this is where they want to put in a substantial amount of capital into the project. They're saying, okay, well, a lot of the HVAC units or boilers or appliances are not going as well. The building now is starting to look a little drabby, dreary. We may want to update the lobby, those kinds of things. So they want to spend a couple $1 million now, and they would like a higher return because of it. What their goal is to convert, what looks like a value add product into what looks like a Core Plus product. And so they may step in. And then on the far end of the spectrum are, your 1960s, 1970s, assets that are ready for teardowns, and they've basically reached the end of the useful life. So with every asset class that, whether it's multifamily, office, retail, or industrial, every asset class goes through that same life cycle experience as well. Every asset within those asset classes. Is that helpful?
Thank you, Chi. Mm-hmm. Next question is, I can answer. I have an Entrust self-directed IRA. I have moved the funds to a business checking under an LLC with the original intent of direct deal investing. Can I use these funds for investing in REITs? So essentially, this individual has an IRA LLC, and you can make any investment within that LLC as long as it falls within the IRS guidelines. So REITs do. But Chi, if you want to elaborate further on LLC investors in a REIT.
Yeah, I think it's possible. Obviously, you know, this is a great question to defer straight to your tax folks on how exactly to model it and invest through it. But yes, to my knowledge, there's no issue. It's just a structuring question with your CPA.
Thank you. Next question. If I understood one point made here is direct real estate investment is limited to an accredited investor. Can you expand further on that point, Chief?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily limited to an accredited investor, but securities laws have certain things. So look, the SEC is designed to protect the investor's interest. So what they say is investors need to have a certain amount of information provided to them before making an investment. When a company decides to go public or a REIT is publicly posted, there is a tremendous amount of information that the REIT or any other publicly traded company needs to provide to the general population, which is why the SEC allows the general population to invest passively in those securities, i.e. stocks. When it comes to a direct deal, it's far harder to get that level of information prepared and disseminated at a reasonable cost, which is why direct deals tend to be done with a smaller subset of investors that the SEC determines as either accredited or qualified clients or qualified companies and or entities. That generally, so there's two rules, and I'll go over this very briefly. I don't want to dive too much, but under SEC Regulation D, which is an exemption from SEC, there are two categories that we generally use for syndicating deals or sponsoring deals, which are called 506B and 506C. 506B basically says you can have up to 35 non-accredited investors, but they must have some sophisticated knowledge of investing generally. So we call them sophisticated investors as defined by the SEC. So with that category, yes, you can invest as a non-accredited investor into direct deals under an SEC Reg D offering. It's not an SEC offering. It's actually an exempt offering under a Reg D offering. But generally speaking, and for practical purposes, most sponsors do prefer to go the accredited investor route because accredited investors meet a certain threshold where the disclosure requirements are not as onerous on behalf of the sponsor. So that's just the nuance there.
Thank you, Chief. Next question. Chief, this is for you. Can you give some specifics on how many units you have under management? For example, what states are they located in? Average number of units per property?
Yeah, definitely.
Currently partnering with developers to build new units? If so, where?
Yep. Sure. So Upside Avenue is an affiliated entity of Casora Group, right? Which I happen to be the CIO of both Upside Avenue and Casora Group. We have about 5,500 units, particularly heavily located actually in Texas, because Texas has been the fastest growing employment state in the United States, and has been so for a long time. Between Texas and Florida, I think there's some competition there. But we've cycled in and out of properties quite so often. We tend to adopt a little bit more of a, you know, heavy core plus to sort of value add approach, leaning actually more, I'd say, now to value add than anything else. So with that, about 5,500 units, we cycle in and out of maybe, I'd say, about 1,000 units in and out per year to 2,000 units in and out per year, just depending on the year. This year's been a heavy sale period during the earlier part, and our Upside Avenue investors may stand to gain from it in the very near future. Obviously, nothing specific to be disclosed just yet, but our appetite is growing, and we look forward to investing actually quite a bit more in Texas specifically, because we are focused, we are sharpshooters in Texas, and we understand where the growth is occurring in Texas. That said, we are still open to portfolio acquisitions all across the Sun Belt states, particularly Nevada and, you know, well, let's call it Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Florida. Those are really our target states, including actually Tennessee as well. So I hope that gives a bit of a picture there.
Thank you, Chief. Next question, can I invest money held in NTrust in a REIT? If so, what is the process? Yes, you can. As long as you have an open NTrust account, fund it via transfer or rollover. identify the REIT you want to make an investment with, secure the paperwork from that REIT, and then we'll work with you to make sure it gets processed properly. Next question. Where does crowdfunding type real estate investments fit in the diagram of ways to invest in real estate? Yes, you could use your IRA to invest in crowdfunding. If you want to contact either of us offline, we'll be happy to dive deeper into that question. Next question. I was told by Entrust I could not because Entrust could not hold a publicly traded asset. That is correct. The Entrust cannot hold publicly traded stock. Most REITs are private offerings. If it is something that is out there that's publicly traded, we would not be able to custody it. Chi, you want to touch on that?
Yeah, so just to clarify, yes, there are publicly traded REITs, and there are public but non-traded REITs as well. We actually qualify as a public non-traded REIT. This is under what we call Regulation A plus of the Securities Exchange Rules. So yes, this is not a public. I mean, this is not a traded REIT as you would find on a stock exchange, but it is public. So,
thank you. And the last question we have is, I have a traditional self-directed IRA fund investments in LLC. Similar to the prior question, yes, you can make those investments, but it's best to speak to your CPA or advisor to get the best structure on how to make that type of investment. And we'll stay around for another minute or two. If anybody has another question, please type it in now. Oh, one just came in for you, Chi. Mm-hmm. Public non-traded REIT, is that what was just noted?
Correct, yeah. Public non-traded REIT under Reg A, Regulation A.
Thank you. And how do they obtain the publication mentioned?
And the question is, how does the REIT register as a public entity? Is that right?
It says, the question is, if the individual who asked that question wants to elaborate on that, the question directed to us was, how do we obtain the publication mentioned?
The publication mentioned. Okay. If the question is, how exactly does a REIT get certified that way, that's obviously, we go through the SEC regulations that way. If the question is more information on it, the SEC has a fantastic, there's fantastic resources actually on the web for Regulation A. Regulation A is actually crowdfunding. It's the same vehicle. So when we talk crowdfunding, it's actually using the same regulation for different purposes. In our case, our purpose is for a REIT. So if you've got familiarity with crowdfunding regulations, that's basically it.
Sure. He actually did elaborate on his question. He was speaking of the document that you have. So for the individual who asked the question, Chi's contact information is on the screen. Feel free to reach out to him, and they'll be happy to send that over to you.
Wonderful. Sure.
For the I have a Roth IRA, which of these investment models is not more geared towards tax benefits? Not quite sure I understand the question here. When I'm doing any investment in an IRA, you're going to have a tax benefit, whether that's a traditional or a Roth, and you're going to follow the normal tax rules of that exact IRA. Okay, thank you very much. Again, our contact information is on the screen. Should you have any further questions, feel free to reach out to either one of us. We hope you did enjoy the webinar. This recording will be live in our learning center tomorrow. And please reach out to us with further questions. Thank you, everybody, and have a nice day.